May it please the Court. There's no question in this case whether the acts with which Mr. Wilson was charged were...
Counsel, if you could just please use initials or first names as was requested and not last names, I would appreciate it.
Yes, I'm sorry. There's no question in this case whether the acts with which the appellant was charged were reprehensible. The issue before this Court really is whether he received a fair trial. You know, despite whatever he's charged with, he has that basic right to a fair trial. And I wanted to focus my argument primarily on the third point, which is the issue regarding whether the trial court improperly excluded impeachment evidence that the victim in the case wrecked the family car and lied about it, saying that someone else wrecked it when she knew.
Now, the long case was dealt directly with credibility with respect to a similar charge. I mean, the long case, the witness had allegedly made false statements in similar kinds of cases. In this case, it's not the same. It's a different kind of case entirely, isn't it?
Well, I believe in Long, but the victim in that case had made prior allegations of both physical and sexual assault, and it was a sexual crimes case. That's correct. And in this case, I would agree that a car wreck is not the same as an allegation of sexual assault. However, I wouldn't say that it's dissimilar, given the context in which her allegation was made, that it's really intertwined to a degree with the facts in this case. You know, it involves her animosity towards the defendant regarding her mother's illness, which was the exact, you know, circumstance that led to her making the allegations against the defendant in this case.
But she never made the allegations to any authority. She never made them under oath. She never made them to the police. She just made them to family members regarding the car accident. And then when confronted by authorities, she fessed up. So isn't that different than making an allegation of a crime, perhaps in court under oath or to a prosecutor or to investigators, to police?
She didn't, I guess, fess up to the authorities. She initially fessed up to her family members. And then her family members forced her to go to the police, where she apparently told the truth to the police. But she hadn't previously, to my understanding, reported the accident to the authorities.
And tied in with that, there was no formal allegation to the police, but also that there was no allegation as to a particular person, that she alleged a particular person had committed some form of assault, and then it turned out to be false.
Correct. She said that someone else was responsible.
This would be an extension of Long, which is itself sort of at the edge of this area of law in allowing in impeachment based on prior allegations, false allegations and accusations. So what would support taking this yet further?
Well, I wouldn't entirely agree that this is taking it further. You know, the issue in Long was the admissibility of extrinsic evidence to prove this. And the issue in this case is whether the defendant should have been permitted cross-examination on regarding this prior incident. We don't even get to the issue of extrinsic evidence because he was denied to even cross-examine the witness about the situation. And to that extent, Long is, you know, merely persuasive authority. And the main reason why I relied on it is, you know, Long goes into a great deal of discussion about when the credibility of the victim is the crucial issue in the case, as it was in my case.
So tell me then, how is Missouri law different as to, say, Long addresses the issue of when you can get into extrinsic evidence? What is it, you're saying the law is broader here if you're not trying to get in extrinsic evidence but just to cross-examine. So what is that law and what is the distinction between those two areas?
Right. You're looking at under the umbrella of impeachment, and there's always been like this exception for evidence of bias, and even under bias prior to Long, extrinsic evidence could be submitted. And as I've argued in the brief,
cross-examination is confronting your accuser. You're allowed to confront your accuser.
I'm sorry.
Cross-examination without the extrinsic evidence is the right to confront your accuser.
Correct. Right.
So you're saying you could bring in evidence that she had a previous bias against the defendant, but that's different than bringing in evidence of a prior false allegation that somebody else wrecked the car. I mean, that's what you're trying to get in, is this evidence that she lied about who wrecked the car, so she's lying now, which is different than putting in evidence that she was upset with the defendant.
My understanding of bias is that it doesn't have to be an allegation against the defendant to be evidence of bias. Bias is anything that shows like animosity towards the defendant. And
how does her lie about the car?
And it demonstrates animosity towards the defendant because her taking the car in the first place, and which resulted in her wrecking it, was motivated by her anger towards the defendant for his cavalier attitude towards her mother's illness. So she was upset that her mother was in the hospital for a number of months, and the defendant was acting like everything was fine.
But all that can be proven without any evidence of the wreck or the false statements, couldn't it?
Right.
Did you separately seek to admit that?
The defense attorney at trial made an offer of proof seeking to introduce the evidence of the car accident, which was her deposition testimony that went into detail about how it came about and how, when she was confronted by her relatives and by the defendant, that she finally admitted it, and then the defendant made her go to the police. So it shows bias both for the animosity towards the defendant regarding mother's illness and the fact that he is the one that made her go to the police, and for which she ended up getting in trouble with the law for it.
But she didn't get in trouble for lying. She just got in trouble for having the accident and not reporting it at the time, but not for any false allegations, because she told the police the truth.
Well, the record's not clear as to what charges were filed against her by the police. My assumption would be that it's property damage, but the record's silent on that precise issue.
I think the intent of our questions are kind of clear, that these could have been separated out, and there apparently was no attempt to. Was it an can we say the trial court erred in not doing that sua sponte when counsel didn't offer just the parts that dealt with her attitude towards him, but tied it in with prior false allegations?
I think this case presents an opportunity for the court to clarify the law on this matter, whether it's extrinsic evidence or just cross-examination. I don't think that it's been crystal clear prior to Long. I would note in the Danny Wolf decision, and Judge Wolf's dissent talks about the Williams case and that prior acts of conduct that relate to untruthfulness are admissible.
So you're back to extrinsic evidence here, as opposed to, you're dealing here with your argument about extrinsic evidence or cross-examination.
I'm sorry.
Are you addressing the right to include extrinsic evidence or cross-examination here?
Both. Okay. Cross-examination and extrinsic evidence.
Okay.
I think there's some conflict in the case law, but because this is it shows bias and it's an act of untruthfulness as far as lying about a car accident that happened, but to her family, that something that directly goes to impeach her credibility in the case, her veracity as a witness, and her credibility was the most important issue for this jury to determine. There was. And in a lot of ways, this is a stronger case than Long. In Long, there was some physical evidence. The woman went to the hospital like 2 days after the incident and had physical evidence of abuse. And in this case, we have nothing like that. The victim didn't report the incident for over 9 months. All we have are her empty allegations that this happened. There's no physical hospital evidence corroborating in what she said. There's no other type of physical evidence, such as sheets or clothing or anything that was seized, that would have bodily fluids proving that the defendant did this. All we have are her empty allegations in the case. And by not letting the defendant cross-examine the witness about matters that go directly to her veracity, he was deprived of his right to present a full defense in the case, which his defense is, of course, that she was making the allegations up. The defendant didn't testify, but he shouldn't have to to waive one constitutional right in order to invoke another one. He shouldn't have to waive his right to silence and not testify at trial in order to be able to present his defense in the case.
Okay.
Also, in comparing this case to Long, in this case there was no other evidence that was showing that the victim's reputation for truthfulness was poor, where in Long, apparently there was other evidence on a subject that was admitted. And in here, you know, the defendant was denying the allegations outright, whereas in Long, the defendant in that case was arguing that the sex was consensual. So I think in this case it's even more critical. The only way the jury was going to find the defendant guilty was that they believed the victim. And apparently the jury...
I believe there's a question.
I'm sorry.
...we used to review the judge's determination, because it seems to me the question about prior acts of dishonesty is really a question of relevance. And don't we give the trial judge some discretion in terms of what is determined to be relevant?
So there is some discretion. And
if you lie about a sexual offense, it is certainly seen on a greater scale of relevance than an automobile lie.
I would agree that, you know, the more similar the offense, the stronger the connection.
My question is really about the standard of review.
The standard of review would be an abuse of discretion, and you know, the appellant is submitting in this case that the court abused its discretion. And you know, you have to balance the probative value of the evidence, which I say that this evidence that she lied and the way that it was intertwined with kind of the same circumstances for making the allegations against the defendant regarding her mother's illness and so on, and that it was an act of untruthfulness, it goes to its probative value. And you know, the weight of it could be determined by the jury. But the prejudice to the state in this would have been minimal. It would have not taken that very much time to just cross-examine this witness about the situation. It would have given...
Long doesn't say just any time the defendant lied or the complaining witness lied, you can bring it in.
Right. I think the court in Long does try to be, you know, careful and particularly, I guess, the dissent in saying that not every type of lie should be admitted. But this isn't trying to say, you know, that she lied to teachers at school or, I mean, there is an interconnection between this lie and the facts of the case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I will skip to point 3 as well. And in this case, the defendant was prohibited from cross-examining the victim about a car accident that happened in July of 2004. She took her mother's car, got in a car accident, brought it back home, and ran the house and said somebody must have hit the car. And she was confronted by her two cousins who said, no, someone moved this car. Someone moved this car. No one hit it. And then she was confronted by the appellant, and he said, you did it, you did it. And she confessed. She said, yes, I did it. She was not forced to go out to the police. There was no evidence of that. She went down to the police station, reported the accident, and that's all the facts we have. We have no evidence that she was forced to go to the police, but that she went on her own will. So in this case, he was prevented from asking about this prior car accident. This has no relevance to the facts at hand.
Is it, would our standard be lower for admitting, for allowing them to cross-examine her about that to show her truth and veracity and it to affect her credibility than it would be for admitting extrinsic evidence?
No, I think the rule is the same about the relevance analysis. What happens with extrinsic evidence is you have to prove that it actually was false and that the victim knew it was false when she told
Well, you could, the middle ground is to allow cross-examination. And if she denies that she lied about the car crash, you're stuck with it.
Yeah.
Because I think the trial judge ought to have some leeway, don't you, to not have the trial be a trial, you know, separate factual trials about whether she had a car accident and lied about it some years ago.
I agree, but the rule prior to Long and after Long was still that to cross-examine about a prior act of misconduct, you have to prove it's relevant, and this court in Long dictated how you prove it's relevant by balancing out.
But Long dealt with extrinsic evidence. It didn't address cross-examination. So,
but it still dealt with prior false allegations and whether they're...
Yeah, but I'm asking, what's the law on cross-examining about lies?
Because
what is
the
general
is
law,
generally
regardless
inadmissible.
Of law?
The rule on prior acts of misconduct is generally inadmissible. So that's the general rule. So you have to prove that there's an exception, and proving this.
But it used to be... before long you could ask about them, but then you were stuck with the answer in certain circumstances. What was the standard we applied to decide when you could ask?
I think you still had to prove that it was somehow relevant, because I think it's still, regardless, you could ask about cross-examination.
So what is our, so the standard is that
you have to prove it's relevant by, because it shows a bias or a motive, and in this case we have neither. We don't have, it's not relevant to bias. There was no bias in this car accident because she was confronted by an appellant. I think in this case, it shows that she actually was scared of appellant and she deferred to him because whenever he confronted her, she told the truth.
So if, just so you could not admit it just so general that you'd lied a lot. It has to be relevant to bias towards this defendant or towards these facts or towards something relevant to the case.
A specific act, no, you cannot show on cross. If it's a general reputation for untruthfulness,
right.
Yes, that's allowed.
But not specific incidents.
I think a specific incident has to be relevant somehow to bias and motive.
And I thank you.
That's the question I was going to make, that previously, prior to Long, you could not show that specific instances of lying as evidence that this person was untruthful. Is that correct?
And even so, yes.
The only way they were admissible was if you could show that this person lied and got some advantage, so they had a motive to lie in this case because they knew they might benefit by having custody changed or something.
Exactly. There's a long line of cases that have said you can cross-examine about these because they're related to motive to fabricate.
And the difference in Long was that Long allowed it to show propensity to lie. Is that a correct assessment of Long?
Yes. I would agree that they would say that making prior false allegations of a similar or same offense is relevant to show they had a propensity to make these false allegations, and it's relevant.
And it wasn't, that Long didn't require that it be related to showing one of the normal exceptions to prior bad acts.
No, because Long involved involved false allegations against other people not related to the defendant, so there was no bias it goes to motive to fabricate.
So if someone were charged with sexual harassment, and then as their allegations made that this person had sexual relations with an intern, and they lied, you couldn't go any further with that. Would that be relevant then, that the sexual relations with an intern to the sexual harassment charge?
I think that...
If they lied about the relationship with the sexual intern. How about the intern?
I think you have to weigh. And so anytime it's relating sexual offense, then it might have more relevance than a non-similar offense. And that goes to the trial court's weighing in that process. But those aren't the facts here. And we have a car accident and we have sodomy and rape. Two entirely different
types. Or someone was convicted or disbarred for perjury because of that same, then maybe that would be sufficient.
I think it would go, it'd weigh more heavily one way or the other. I mean, we still have this balancing where we're asking the trial courts to weigh this, and then we go back on appeal and we say, no, your judgment was wrong, but what we're doing is saying that you abused your wide discretion, and then that, but in this case, we can all say reasonable persons can differ about whether this is a false allegation or not, and so if reasonable persons can differ, then the trial court did not abuse its discretion.
Can the defense call witnesses to establish that this woman is a liar?
The defense can do that if it's general reputation, unless it falls under a prior false allegation.
Well, how do I know she's a liar? Well, she lied about the automobile accident. Is that proper testimony?
That would be a prior act. That would be a specific bad act, which is not. You have to show that more than just one incident, because then otherwise you're putting the victim on trial and smearing the victim. You're going to have collateral,
victim's credibility is precisely at the center of this case.
You know, and that's the thing about sexual offenses.
You can talk about it
as
putting the victim on trial. That's a bit pejorative. What we're really talking about is whether the victim is a victim and whether she's telling the truth.
Yes, but if you're going to bring in every prior falsehood that the person has ever told, all we're going to have is a huge amount of mini trials after mini trials to decide what's relevant. How far do we go back? Do we go back to when they were 5 years old?
What I was really trying to ask is, how should the defense proceed to attack the credibility of a complaining witness who's really the heart and soul of this case? By what?
I think you have to file a motion saying you're going to bring this in, and prior to trial, they have a hearing where they ask the victim, did you do this? And then she denies it. Then you have to prove by preponderance of the evidence whether this lie actually occurred.
But you can also get a reputation for truth.
Yes, mm-hmm. And that's always been allowed, that you right. can have a general truth and reputation, which is right. done in sex offense cases all the time.
For a number of these type of things, don't you have to lay a foundation at trial? Lay a foundation to answer some of these questions.
But that can be done outside
and,
the jury.
Well, what I'm, you, did they lay that foundation here at all? Was there any foundation laid with this witness about her own testimony and her own truth and veracity that would allow her to be cross-examined on it?
the deposition that shows, I mean, she admitted it. So I think.
No, I mean at trial.
At trial, was there anything done?
Do you always tell the truth? Have you always told the truth? Have you ever lied to people? Did they ask any kind of questions like that to set up this type of cross-examination? Or is this just a cold motion in limine that was renewed at trial and we have no context to look at it?
There is really not a lot of context because it appears like after the victim testified, they went back on the record and said, prior to cross-examination, defense counsel asked me if he could ask about this car accident, which I denied, and then they did an offer of proof. So it is more of a cold record in the sense of we don't know. But we do know what happened on cross-examination is that they did ask about her motives and her dislike of the appellant. And she said, no, I don't like him. I don't like him telling me what to do. He's not my father. So I think her bias and motive was revealed on cross-examination. And I think in the end you have to look at, okay, so what if this was presented to the jury? Would this have made a difference? Would the jury have looked at this car accident as really affecting her credibility or more than just a 16-year-old teenager's car accident? This is just an ordinary transgression of a 16-year-old and not really truly relevant because it is so wholly dissimilar.
Well, was there an attempt to ask her about whether she was upset with the defendant because of his treatment of her mother and his seemed lack of caring when she was in the hospital and so forth?
I don't know. I don't remember exactly from the record.
Would that have been objectionable, or that would have?
No, I think you can. They could have asked about that. That wasn't prohibited. Trial counsel wasn't precluded from asking those types of questions. He was just precluded from asking about this one specific act of lying, and that's how he phrased it. I want to ask her about this one incident of lying to impeach her credibility. It's nothing to do with bias or motive. And so I think that we have to look at what the trial court had before it and determine that it did not abuse its discretion in precluding this wholly dissimilar incident of lying, one incident of lying.
Did they try any other ways of going after the credibility, any like a reputation promise or any of that kind of thing as part of the defense case?
I don't believe they asked about any other prior incidents because, as far as we know, there was no other. She didn't have a reputation for untruthfulness, as far as we know, from the record. So, I mean, they asked her about her dislike and like of the appellant.
There was a question that was asked, and I think it was by Judge Price, concerning reputation testimony. And could specific acts of lying be brought up when someone is testifying about reputation? Do you know what the law is on that, Kit? Because you can impeach, you can refute the reputation testimony with specifics, can't you?
I believe that if you attack the credibility, then you're allowed to rebut that. I think, and that's what I guess a fear is also, is that what happens if they do attack the victim's credibility, does then the state have the opportunity?
But what I'm saying is if you bring in reputation witnesses, those witnesses can be cross-examined and their opinion can be refuted with additional information. Isn't that possible under reputation testimony?
I believe so. How I've seen it is they brought in like teachers and said something like this victim has continuously lied or told untruths or something, but they've never gone into journals on direct, and maybe on cross they go in and they ask, you know, how do you know or how well is your knowledge? They question the actual.
There's an ability to cross-examine as to the basis of their opinion of reputation.
Yes.
Your opposing counsel says that you opened the door to the subject by referring to the car accident in your line of questioning. What's your response to that?
Opening the door, this is not opening the door. A passing reference to an inadmissible incident in this case is not opening the door. Opening the door is when you use that statement for your advantage. You're using it, and so the defense is entitled to rebut that negative inference. So that, in this case, is not opening the door. And I believe that wasn't even alleged. And if you do open the door, then you have to say, Your Honor, I believe that the state has opened the door. I can now ask this about this inadmissible thing. Because you have to do that. Otherwise, there's no way.
What did the state put on about the accident?
I'm sorry.
What evidence did the state put
on? She was referring when they were asking her about how do you remember when these rapes occurred. And she said, well, I remember July because this thing happened with my mom's car. And that was the only reference to it. It was vague. There was no positive inference for the state in this sense that came from that. So that's not opening the door under this court standard. The court doesn't have any more questions. The state will rest on its brief and ask that you affirm the conviction of the census.
Thank you, counsel.
First of all, the state said that all the evidence shows that she went to the police on her own will, and I don't think that that's the case at all. If you read the offer of proof, she's talking, you know, about the defendant saying that he came and he's trying to, you did it, smart talking to me, loud talking to me, and all that. Went down to the police station on Jefferson, and I had told him, and basically that's it. I don't think you can infer from that that she went to the police station on her own free will. I did want to just briefly get on and address count one, point one of my brief regarding insufficient evidence on the multiple counts, and particularly in looking at the statutory rape counts. The state repeatedly through its brief says that the victim said that she had sexual intercourse with the defendant 8 times. So if you read her testimony, she never, ever says that she had sexual intercourse with the defendant 8 times. If you go through her testimony, she, you know, the state asked her about one incident, and she's like, the first thing that happened is he stuck his fingers in me and he had sexual intercourse with me. And the state asked what happened next. The next time he looked at me and he had sexual intercourse with me. And the prosecutor asked, was that the next time or the third time? Where she's trying to get in to this count four that they presented no evidence on. You go through the testimony, all these times that are discussed are times that included both acts of rape and sodomy. And so therefore, when the victim says that there were 8 times, she's referring to eight days that she was abused by the defendant, and those abuse constituted acts of rape and sodomy. And I don't think, based on her testimony, that when she says that he did it to her on 3 other times in July, November, and December, that can be used to infer that all the other incidences were sexual intercourse. And then the state also makes the argument that time is not of the essence. But if you look at the cases that the state is referring to, they're looking at time being of the essence. And, for example, where a child victim has, I think the first case that they cited, the child victim, the woman was 23 and was made the report to the police, and the incident had happened when she was 7 years old. And you're looking at a time span where it's going to be impossible for that victim to pinpoint what happened. That is not the case here. Here we have the victim saying it happened in July, November, and December. And the state was trying to get her to say that something happened in April to meet the allegation of count four, and she, you know, refused to say that it happened then. So basically the victim made time of the essence. She said it happened on these specific dates, and one of the dates in particular did not line up with what the charges were. And another one that the state, or the court, entered a directed verdict but didn't on this one. I believe I'm going over.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Your time is up. Thank
so
you.
Thank you for your comments.
The case is submitted.